So we are now recording the audio only of the session. And I'd like to kick it over to Linda Buskey to present on the findings from the survey. So Linda, it's all yours.
Okay. Presentation here so you can see it okay?
Yep.
Great. Okay, well, thanks, Chris. And I'll get going on the survey findings. So it was an anonymous survey that was launched on July 13th and online only, and Alan designed the questionnaire using Google Forms. There were verbal reminders about the survey at the Q&A sessions, and there were two email reminders as well. And then it was downloaded, the results were downloaded on July 30th. So the survey went out to 136 members and 95 replied for an error of plus or minus 5% 19 times out of 20 and a whopping great big almost 70% response rate, which is just amazing in this day and age. And it's much higher than the 2020 survey where we got 44%. This one was much shorter, but I think there was just a lot of interest in the topic. So Alan provided me with this chart of the responses as they came in. It's a very typical pattern. You get a lot of replies the first day or two, then it sort of flattens out, then you get an uptick with your reminders, and then it plateaus and you cut it off. So I just wanted to remind people that we did actually ask a question about video conferencing at the 2020 membership survey, which went out in April. So just sort of not, it was before things were locking down tight, but definitely people were kind of thinking this in the back of their mind. So we were asked whether or not, how often you would take advantage of a video conferencing meeting if it was available. And almost three quarters of the respondents of the members said that they would always or often take advantage. So that was quite high, and it was only a very small percent that said they would never take advantage of it, and a surprisingly small percent said when necessary. So just wanted to give you that baseline point from last year. So the demographic questions we asked this time were your length of membership, your age group, and your gender. So in terms of the distribution of the being an OPCUG member, over half were actually quite new members. They were 5 years or less. And that was much greater than the third that we saw in the 2020 survey. Still, everybody's pretty much over the age of 50 in terms of the group. And this time we had 31% of females responding to the survey, which was much larger than the 17% we had in 2020. So a lot of the new members you'll see that have come on are female. So just breaking down the membership categories. So 0 to 5 years, it's about 50-50 male and female. The middle cohort is a relatively small cohort, but it was 100% male. And then the older cohort was about 80% male. So the pre-COVID question, so on average, how many times per year did you attend the in-person monthly meetings? And I added in, just for interest, I added in the NA. Now, NA might be people that were not members then, so they didn't have an opportunity to join the in-person meeting. So if you added those in, you have 86%, which is a good number. But it's good to keep in mind that there was 14% that never did attend the in-person meeting. So you already have members that wouldn't be attending an in-person meeting in the future because they never have anyway. So during Zoom, during COVID, we had the Zoom meeting. So since April 2020, how many times did you attend the monthly virtual Zoom meetings? And you had 80% attending, which I think is good too. The zero went up a bit to 20%, but I think the fact that people embrace the Zoom quickly and competently, I think, is satisfying to know. So what's really interesting was, since April 2020, how many times did you attend the weekly Q&A sessions on Zoom? And these were set up by Alan and Chris. And you've got 74% of the membership attending at least one Q&A during that period, which I think is amazing because there's no way you had those kind of numbers at the church when the Q&A started at after nine. And I say you because I was never there. It was past my bedtime. So this is really great that so many people are coming out to the Q&A. So post-COVID, within public health guidelines, et cetera, people were asked if virtual Zoom meetings are always an available option. How likely are you to attend an in-person meeting if? And then various scenarios. So full vaccination and mask required. That was likely or neutral by just over 70% of the respondents. And then full vaccination, mask optional. That was still strong, slightly less. Not huge support for situations where no vax is required. So no vax required, but you do have to wear a mask. Not huge numbers and very low numbers for no mask or vax required. So this, I think, is the main graph that the board wanted to get out of the survey. This is the direction that they needed the most. So just breaking that down a bit by that you were likely to attend. So for those that are newer members versus the 6+ year membership, with the vax and mask situation, the longer term members were more likely to want to attend. And I think that's probably, you know, they're more invested in the club. They've probably got some long term friendships, etc. So I'm not surprised at that result. Same sort of difference with the mask, no mask and but a vax. And then no real differences, just no real interest, strong interest for the situations where no vaccine was required. So male and female differences. Males more likely to want to attend the in-person meetings. This might be confounded with the fact that a lot of the females are new members. So the fact that the new members were less likely, I didn't have enough numbers in the database to do split out males and females by newer members and older members. So it's a bit of a mix there. But the same sort of difference with females in the vaccination, but the optional masks scenario, but no real difference in the no vaccination scenarios. So here are just some of the comments that were written in on question four. Pretty much all of them. I did a bit of editing on them and shortening than that, but I think I've captured all the ideas. And one I thought was kind of interesting was, you know, all sorts of reasons to protect yourself and others by wearing a mask and not just for COVID, which I thought was kind of interesting comment. So the next question was, how willing would you be to forego in-person meetings if there were a few in-person outdoor social events held throughout the year? So here's the graph for this one. And over half the respondents said they were either very willing or somewhat willing. And if you add in the neutral group, you're up to like 84%. So very, very small proportion of the membership are either somewhat unwilling or very unwilling to give up the forego the in-person meetings. And then 6% said it depended on the event. So breaking down again by membership, more willing to forego the meetings if you were a newer member and if you were female. So are you more likely to attend an in-person meeting if there is an in-person speaker? So almost half said yes, 17% said no, and 18% said it depends on the speaker. So that might be a situation where, you know, if it's me or Alan or Chris or someone that's just a member, that might not be as motivating to attend as if it was an outside guest. So breaking down for membership, longer-term members more likely to attend an in-person meeting with an in-person speaker, and more males again. So what factors would influence you in attending an in-person meeting? So what I did was I just grouped them by the strongest factor. That's the strong factor is the navy blue bar. So the one that came out on top was easy to see and hear the speaker. But community and camaraderie was very close. And when you add in the neutral, it actually exceeds the first one. And then conversing with members. Now, obviously, the descriptions were a little longer in the questionnaire. I've shortened them here for the graph. But interacting with the speakers, evening out, et cetera, as you go down the list. So there were no differences in the factors in favor of in-person meetings between membership status or males versus females. So this one, again, some interesting comments. I like the one that said less likely to get distracted by events unrelated to the meeting at an in-person event. And we've all experienced that, you know, like if you're in the house and you're on a Zoom, you might get pulled away by a pet or a spouse or whatever, or, you know, an email pops in or something like that. So that's just one of the advantages that someone noted. And then someone else said that perhaps there should be only one or two in-person meetings per year, maybe, you know, not in flu season or something. So what factors would influence you in attending a virtual Zoom meeting? So this was kind of interesting because weather came out on top. We're so Canadian. Weather came out on top, replay of the meetings, easier to see the slides. And this was a particular interest to me on this slide, because if I was presenting this at in the church, you would have to be practically on top of me to see the labels on the y-axis there. It just would be the font's too small. But I'm sure even if you're looking at it on a tablet right now, you're not having any difficulty. So that is one of the advantages of Zoom, is that the presenters can use smaller fonts. So illness and fatigue, no boots, coat, hat, so the pain in the neck factor, chat and links, comfier chair, et cetera, et cetera. The beverage of choice, no difference between men and women on that one, which was because I had to check all these, of course, for differences. Polling function, et cetera. So in terms of weather, more of a strong factor for the newer members than the older members. Again, the older members have more skin in the game, I think, and are more motivated to attend in person. Replay of the meeting, again, younger, newer members. Seeing the speaker slides and driving at night. So I just picked ones where I thought there were significant differences. Same with males and females. The weather was more a factor for females. The illness or fatigue may not be statistically significant because my numbers are fairly small for these cohorts. And then seeing the speaker slide and driving at night. So again, interesting comments on some of the things that are good about Zoom. But I like the one at the end, especially. Much of what is discussed goes over my head. With Zoom, I can choose to participate in just one or two topics. And I think this is really important because, you know, if I saw the agenda for the Q&A and, you know, there was three or four items that I thought I might not even understand, would I drive, you know, halfway across town to attend? But it's certainly easy to plug into Zoom and listen to the sections that I do understand and tune out if I don't, and no one's insulted, and I don't feel I've wasted an evening, and I've learned things that I never thought I could. So I think that's a very positive statement. I didn't write that statement in, but I thought whoever did was on the right track. So if OPCUG decides to have only virtual meetings, to what extent do you agree that cost savings could be dispersed in the following manner? So increasing the honorary for speakers came out way, way, way on top. Only 3% disagreed. Then funding education, technical education, keeping the cost savings in the reserve fund. Door prizes, event tickets, et cetera, and then the last one being catering event beyond the pizza nights that are currently held. So more likely to want to agree with funding education if you were a newer member, and more likely to wanting to keep it in the reserve fund. But newer members might not even have experienced the financial report yet, so they may not realize just how healthy the reserve fund is. So male-female differences, stronger agreement amongst females for funding education, increasing the honoraria, slight, maybe not significant difference there, keeping in the reserve and online subscriptions. So comments, Alan and Chris deserving kudos for the work they're doing on Q&A, and couldn't agree more with that one. And then I just wanted to comment on the last one, that if the average age of the group does not come down, the group's fund savings might be dispersed in a gradual manner over all the above. I don't think the club has to worry about the average age of the group. There's lots of seniors clubs around town that survive for decades. As long as you're going to have attrition, as long as you have new people coming in, I don't think it really matters the age of them, as long as you're replacing your attrition. That's just my editorial comment. So just some other comments that were at the end of the survey, and I really liked the last one, was I have found a new pool of friendships, which I think really speaks to the club. It's hard on Zoom to reach out to new people, make them feel welcome, but clearly we have, and I think that's really good news. So that's it, and thanks to everybody for completing the survey. And I will turn it back to Chris to see if there's any questions or comments through the chat. Oh, Chris, you're muted.
Yep, I know. I just just trying to hit the right button. Okay, thanks very much, Linda. Linda helped immensely with developing the survey and making sure that the questions that we were asking made sense and would give us actionable information. So kudos to Linda for that and for doing the analysis after the fact. So the board will certainly take into consideration everything that is in the results. We do have a couple of minutes, so I forgot to mute everybody. So people, if you are muted, you can unmute yourself if you're currently unmuted. If you have any questions, by all means, shout out. We have a couple of comments. We have Linda, excellent content. Very well done. Wow, thank you. And thanks, Linda, a lot for the interesting answers. Linda, you did a very good job on the stats. Excellent presentation, Linda. Thanks for the survey and for sharing the analysis. So all kudos, no complaints about anything about being biased or anything like that. Great analysis, Linda. And I don't hear anybody coming up with any questions. Hopefully at the end of tonight, we will have some time. Did somebody speak up?
Chris, it's Corrine. I just have one observation. It's to do with, whether you have the vaccines or not. Because the survey came out in the summer, and then, some of us that maybe had one vaccine, some hadn't, do you think the timing of when people were double vaxxed and they've already answered the survey made a difference in the results in terms of whether they would go out or not?
I wouldn't think so, because nobody at that time, we weren't even considering coming back to the church until at least mid-fall and possibly even later. So
I think by July, everybody kind of had a notion of, a lot of us had the first one. Maybe we were booked already for the second one. So I think we were able to at least picture what it would be like, even though it wasn't going to be in the immediate future. And yes, any survey is, you have to place it in the time period. So if you did a survey just before an election or just after an election, it's going to be different. So it is a good thing to keep in mind, Corrine, but I think for the most of us, we were sort of able to start thinking about how we would feel even if we were double vaxxed or single vaxxed.
So. Yeah. Okay. And the other thing is, when we get back together, because I'm hopeful, maybe, not this year, but maybe next year, do you think we would go the route of having, something shown to say, prove that we're double vaxxed and that kind of thing, a passport is what you're talking about. Do you think that would make a difference for this event, for these events?
Yeah, I don't think that's really been talked about amongst the board members at this point in time.
Okay, I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks.
I do think we have to be extra careful about the vaccination and stuff. It's not a guarantee that we'll be free of COVID. There are a lot of people who have been vaccinated and yet get COVID and transmit it. So
yeah.
I think that we have to wait and see a lot. I think regarding the passport, I think that probably there will be an application available not only for restaurants and bars and stuff like that, but also for groups like us where we want to only allow in the vaccinated. And I think it'd be worthwhile to check.
Yeah. Okay, good point, Sam. Okay, I think we're at the 20-minute mark, which I'm trying to hold everybody to 20 minutes tonight. So hopefully if we hold everybody to 20 minutes, we'll have 10 minutes at the end for general question and answer. So if you have anything about the survey, by all means, hold it till then. And I did neglect to mute all, and what I'm going to do now is mute all for the next presenter. And I will leave it that people have the ability to unmute themselves, but please, during the main part of the presentation, refrain from doing so. I'll leave it that way so that after the presentation is given, you can easily unmute yourself and make whatever comments you want. So, Stéphane, I'll turn it over to you now. You can share your screen and take over for your presentation.
Okay, I'm sharing my screen now, so it should work, sure. It's working, okay. So, a few months ago, I did a presentation on the various building blocks available in Microsoft Access. Now today we'll do a presentation on putting all of these building blocks together to build an expense database. Here we go. So the requirement for the database, so we want a database that can keep track of household expense. So we want it able to be to keep track of the expense date, the expense amount, obviously, who did the expense. Like what person, so you have many person in your household, you can enter them in the database and you can allocate them to that person. An expense category, so you need to be able to create many categories as you want, and when you create an expense, you can again allocate it to a specific category. Enter a note about the expense. Based on this requirement, this will drive how many access objects we need to create and the relationship between these objects. A couple of design hints and lessons learned over many years building database like this. The first thing is you can use space when you're defining object name or field name, but personally I've learned to avoid them and use capital letter and put all the words together. So instead of using method or space of space payment, I will be using method of payment all together with capital letters. It make it easier later on when you want to reference to things and stuff like that. Because if there is space, you need to put special character so Access knows what field name you're talking about. A table field name need to be unique within a table. So in theory, you can have a field name called ID in all the tables that you have in your database. However, when you start building queries on these tables, it gets very hard to figure out which ID you're talking about. So what I'm doing instead is if this ID is specific to the expense table, I will call it expense ID. So it make it easier later on when I build queries to figure out, oh yeah, that's the specific ID that I need. Need to be careful, especially with date, when you want them to sort correctly. And when, for example, if a database will need to group record by month. So that's easy to do, but if I use, for example, January 2021, they will not sort correctly. April 2021 will come first because Access will sort the text as starting with A. So what we need to do in that case is to create two fields. One that you format as a numeric, like this one is 2021-01 to say January, and another word textual for the human being of Jan 2021 to display, and that's relatively easy, and I will show that. So based on the requirement, these are the various objects that we'll need. We'll need obviously an expense table. will need a person table, and this one will have a one-to-many relationship with expense. What that means is that one person can be used many times in the expense table. Same thing, we'll need a category table, and the relationship will be one-to-many with the expense table. Other type of relationship that exists is many-to-many. In that case, we don't need that. We'll need a number of forms to enter and edit the data for each of the table that we listed above. We'll need a query to group the expense per month. And when we have that, we want to be able to group these expense per month and category, so we can get a summary of how much we're spending for the various category. And we'll create two reports, one for each of the query. And lastly, a switchboard is a set of a function available in Access that allow you to create a switchboard with like a menu to navigate through the various forms and the report. Make it easy to use your database, basically. And you need to configure your Access file so that it opens that switchboard form first. So after that, when you click on a specific item in the switchboard, the specific form is open or report or whatever you clicked on. Now we'll switch to the demo. Well done. So what I did is I recorded in a movie the creation of the database, and I will explain the various steps that I'm doing. So start with your Explorer. You right-click and you say New, Microsoft Access Database, and we'll give it the name Expense.
Stefan, I'm not seeing anything on my screen. Oh. I'm just seeing the demo screen. Maybe you need to share a different window.
Oh, okay. I'll do that.
I think you might have to stop sharing and then reshare the right window.
Hold on. Okay, we'll stop sharing and I will do it again. Stop share. Stop sharing. Is it possible that the video is not showing as a I can share?
Well, try sharing now and share whatever window is showing the video.
Okay. No, doesn't work. Okay, so I will do it through the this one here. Okay, do you see this one?
You're not sharing at all right now.
Okay, hold on.
Okay, it started sharing and... Okay, we're seeing your Windows Explorer or File Explorer.
Okay. So sorry for the technical glitch. So let's start this. Okay, so basically you click on New, create Microsoft Database Access, give it a name, Expense. When you open it, Access will want you to enable the content. That's standard, so you click on Enable. That's done. Now we're going to start creating the various table we discussed before. So we're going to give it a name. So we'll start with the category ID. This one is going to be an auto number, meaning it will increment automatically. And I want to make that the primary key. So it will make sure the number is never reused, always increasing. And in that table, we'll need a category name as one of the fields. It's going to be a short text. Is it required? Yes. And index, I will say yes, and I want no duplicate. So this will prevent us from entering the same category name twice. Only one will be allowed. Now we'll save that table and call it category. So it's showing up on my list of table. Since I'm lazy, we'll copy the table and we'll call it person instead of category. And I will say copy the structure only. So it will only copy the definition. So now we have a table person. I will edit that and I will just change the name of the field because the rest of the structure remain the same. Can save a lot of typing by doing that. It's really the same thing. So now we have a category is done. We'll enter some data because when you are building a pick list based on that, it's easier to see if there is data available. So we'll see the first category is restaurant. The next one is, let me think, dental expense. And after that, insurance. Okay, so we have a couple of expense category. Now we're going to do the same thing with person. So the first one is going to be Bob. Next one is going to be Terry. And the third one is going to be Julie. And now if I try to enter Julie again, just to show you, we'll get an error message from Access telling us that it's creating a duplicate value. So that's really useful to keep the data integrity of the database. Now we're ready to create the expense table itself. So we said we wanted an expense date, so we'll choose a data field of date time. The format I pick is the day, month, and letters, and the years, 4 years. By default, it will use today's date, and is it required? Yes. So Access will not let us save the record if there's no date. We'll do the same thing for the next field, which is the expense amount. And in Access, there is a special data type to deal with money. It's called currency. And two decimal place, default value, we'll leave it blank, and required. So you need to put a number to be able to save the number, that expense. And now we're going to do the lookup wizard. This is when you do the pickup list. So we want to be able to pick from the list of categories, sort by name. So this is what the pick list will look like. And I will hide the number, but what will be saved in the database is the number. And we're going to call that field category ID. Because even though Access will show it as the name, what is going to be stored is the ID coming from the category table. So we save the expense table. We're going to do the same thing again for the next one. Oh, you try to create an ID for the expense. I don't need that, so I'll just erase that field. So now I'm doing the person lookup table. Pick up all the field for the person name, so the same that we saw in the table. That's why it was useful to type some data so we have an idea what the pick list will look like, because sometimes it can become fairly complex. Now we'll go back and change that to person ID, because again, it's not the name that is stored is the ID. We said we wanted a not field, but this one I will leave it required. I will leave it at no, but I will say if you put something, it cannot be empty text. And now we have the basic format for our table done. To create a form, it's easy. When you're the table open, you just click create a form and you will build a form based on that. So that's really easy. Same thing for the category. And automatically Access created that table at the bottom. If I don't need it, I can erase it before saving the file. So I will redo it again. So I will create a form based on that table and I will just select that object and erase it because I don't need that. So I will save that. So we'll call it the category form. And we'll do the same thing for the person form. This allows us to easily edit, add the names, the person using the database person names. Now we'll open the expense form. So we have, this is what the user will see when he wants to enter an expense. So let's say the expense amount is $100, category is dental, so it's a pick list. You just select what you want. So now we have saved one record using the form. But before we want to build the query, we need more record because with one, you cannot, especially if you want to group expense by month, you need a few. So I did a couple of line of code in Visual Basic. And what that code does, it creates a number of variables, but it will generate random expense basically. So based on the category, the name, the category, the person we have defined, after that it will loop and it will create basically 1,000 records. And it did that it doesn't even show, it's less than a second that it took to create these 1,000 random records. If I refresh the table, before we had one record, and now suddenly we have 1,001 records that are contain random data, but it's just to help us build the query, run the query to figure out if they work correctly. So now I'm starting to build the query. The first one is I want to be able to group these expense by month. So I will use the trick that I show you. I talk about in the slide that we need the expense date in a different format. So I call it YM for year month. And the format for that one is going to be the numerical format that I described. So the year as a number and the month as a number. So this will be used for sorting. And the next one, again, the same expense date field, but it will be displayed in a different way. It will be displayed using the month, the three-letter month, dash the year. And this is mainly for the human being, so it can be easy to read it. And I will leave the original expense date. So if I run that query, I can see that August is 2108, August, and all of the other information is exactly the same. I will ask now to sort by the proper date, and now the sorting works properly. So I will save that query. I will say expense by month. And now I can build the next query based on that query. So I will go and select that query. So now I have the expense by month. I just drag and drop the field that I need. And on that one, I don't need the expense date anymore, but I need the, I want to do the category first. And now in the total, when I clicked on that, it will group by this date, group by the category. But for the expense, I don't want Excel to group it. I want to make the sum of that. And I want that column to be called sum. So when I run that, now it just group all of these expense for that month and the category restaurant, and this is how much we spend in that month, a lot of money. And we're going to save that query as the month and by category. I'm going to save that so it appears on the list on the left. I can do the same thing. I can create a report on that query, and I can I just make sure that query is selected. I click create a report, and Access will give me like a report with all the fields. On this one, I want to add a group for the month, and I sort by the expense date. And when I have that, I will go in the design view and I will delete some information that I don't need. It's still available, but it's not in the proper place in the report. So I just move box around and now I have the month that the human being can read and all the expense that we have done in that month. And they are sorted by the day that the expense was done. And I will save that report. I will do the same thing for the report regarding the expense category. So again, Access created the base report, and I just play with the format right now to make the column easier to read. I will add the grouping by month. I will add a sort to sort by the category name. And again, I will do some cleanup because there's some field that I don't need to show. So I will delete some information and move other around. And if I run that now, you will see it gave us a much shorter report, how much we spent on restaurant, dental, and insurance. I could have done the same report to have, instead of buying by category, to have it by people if you want. Now we'll create a switchboard. So I just selected that in the menu in Access. So now we have the interface to design the switchboard. So the first thing I want to do is be able to add an expense. So that's what the name will be. And what I wanted to do is go open a form in add mode. Basically, it will not show all the records out there. It will show me a blank record. The next one is edit an expense. You already have entered an expense. I can go and edit it, and it will show all the expands. I just need to navigate and find the right one. The next thing I need is to be able to edit or add the category. So this one will be edit add mode, and I will select the category form. And I need one to do the same thing for the person. So you're going to be edit or add a person. And that's done. Next thing I need is to be able to see the reports. So the first one is the report by month. And after that, we select open a report, and automatically the list of report is shown. I pick the one I want, and I will do the next report with the expense by month by category. And again, we're going to select open a report, and the report, we're going to select the right one. And the last thing we need is to be able to go back in the switchboard manager to, if you want to add report or something like that. So we'll do that. It's called the design application. And the last thing we need is to be able to quit the database, and it's basically it's the application. So now we created a dashboard. We close that. He created a form, so if open, sorry, that's the table where the switchboard information is stored, and he created a new form called switchboard that has all the items that we describe. And if we click on these things, he will open the report, or he will open the form to edit an expense, or the form to add an expense, exactly what we request for it to do. The last thing we need to do is to tell Access to use that form when it opens. So there's an option, display form. We selected the switchboard, and the next time we open a database, that form will be showing up like this, basically ready to go. So Chris asked me to design and build a database in 15 minutes, and I was able to do it. I know it was fast, but
okay, Seth, thanks very much. I want to remind everybody that the MP4 video, as well as the audio from tonight, will get posted on the website. Stefan, we had a question from Greg. He's looking to see whether you would be willing to share the actual database file.
Yes.
Okay, maybe cut it down from 1,000 records to keep it a little bit smaller. But if you get that to me, I can get that posted onto the website as well. So these files will all be under the past meetings section on the website. Real whirlwind tour of Access, to be sure. But that's pretty amazing to be able to create all of that in 15 minutes.
Just to clarify, it's an M4A audio file, not an MP4 video.
Stefan has been showing an MP4 video file and talking about it. So the MP4 video file will be there to show the screen everything that he was going through. So both those will be there. The audio and the video files will get posted. A reminder, too, that if you, going back to the presentation on the survey results, if you have any further questions or comments on that, feel free to send them to any of the board members or suggestion box at opcug.ca. The board will be sure to take all those things into consideration. Okay, so we're just a couple of minutes over, which is not bad considering how things usually go. So thanks very much, Stefan. And one other thing, there will be a vote tonight for the best presentation by a non-board member. And so after Tom's presentation tonight, we'll throw up an online poll, and the winner will get a 2 terabyte external hard drive. So please stick around for the vote on that. And now I'm going to take over, and I'm going to share screen.
Stefan, what version of Access were you using? Was it 16 or 19?
Okay, we'll get that answer.
It was 2019. Yeah, okay. This one is, I've seen a big difference between the version before and the 2019. Like to create a form and stuff like that, the thing that it does automatically, it was much, it's much, much, much easier to do it with that version of Access than the previous one.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to take everybody on a tour of my adventures in making a logo. Before I get into it, I want to mention that even if you're not interested in creating a logo, you may find some interesting things in here because I used a couple of pieces of software and a service that you may find useful for other projects that you may be working on. So keep that in mind as I go through if there's something that you could use for some other purpose. So this all started when I went to a website by Scott Davenport, who's a photographer out of California, and he had this logo on his website. And I thought, that looks kind of cool. And I thought, I should have a logo so I could watermark my photos as well when I'm out about taking photos of people or properties or, you know, I want to photograph somebody's backyard. I knock on the front door and ask them if I can photograph in their backyard or whatever. Kind of nice if I have a business card with contact info on it. And first off, they probably less likely to think of me as just creep wandering around their neighborhood and more likely just a creep who makes business cards. But they could email me and ask for copies of the photos as well if they want, and I'm happy to do that for them. So some of the design ideas I had, I wanted it a little bit simpler, the Scott Davenport's logo. So the overall idea was that I wanted my name in a handwriting script, and I wanted the word photography underneath it, something like what you see there. But that's not what I wanted it to look like, so that's just the overall concept. So for the handwriting script, I looked at the fonts that come with Windows, and so I considered Comic Sans. Now, anybody who saw my presentation on typography in May knows that I'm just kidding. I would absolutely never use Comic Sans for this particular purpose, for sure. I looked at Bickley script, and a little bit fancy for me. It also is a little bit stressed, where parts of the stroke are thicker than others, and I thought that the thin parts of the strokes, as this gets sized down smaller to fit in the corner of a photograph or something, it might disappear. So I didn't like the amount of stressing there was on that. Freestyle script, for me, it's a little bit of an ugly script, but you know, I'm not making a judgment. If you think that that's a wonderful script, that's fine for you. It's just that for me, I didn't really like it that much. Brush script MT, I didn't really like it as a script either. And then I also went outside of Windows scripts, and I looked, for example, at defonts.com, which has probably hundreds of signing scripts or handwriting scripts. And I saw one, Rothligo's, and I thought, that's pretty nice, a little bit stressed. So, again, those thin parts of the strokes could disappear as I size things down. So maybe it wasn't appropriate. I also looked at commercial typefaces. So I went to myfonts.com, which is run by Monotype, and they are basically a shop for or a storefront for various foundries that they can sell their typefaces through. And the one on the top right, Chin Up Buttercup, is a solid one. The other ones are what's known as a brush script, where you see through part of the letter. It's sort of like it's done with a brush, and so there are parts that are sort of missed in strokes and things like that. And I thought those looked kind of cool to have that brush script effect on it. And I actually settled on Eastgood as a commercial typeface that I kind of liked, and so I decided I would go with it. For the word photography, I wanted a geometric typeface, which means that it's a sans serif. It has very open counters, very even strokes. There's no stressing. Every part of the stroke is the same weight or very close to that. And as such, they'd be very readable when things get scaled down. I settled on Bierstadt, which is a new font that Microsoft has commissioned. And if you look at the differences, like sometimes they're subtle. But for example, if you look at the O and the G between these two typefaces, you know, this one is much more closed vertically than this one is, or horizontally rather, than this is. I like that more open one. It would be more readable as things get smaller. And then I letter spaced it very heavily, so spreading out the letters just for an effect. So the final design that I came up with looked like this. So to get a logo onto an actual photo, in the photo editor, I can just do an insert text. And I would have to insert two text elements because they were different typefaces. Unfortunately, the photo editor that I use and pretty much all photo editors, they have very poor typographical control. So I wasn't able to do the letter spacing on the word photography. So I wanted to look at another means of accomplishing this. So I thought, no problem. I could design it in PowerPoint or whatever I want. Take a screenshot and then insert that onto a photo. And I came up with that, which I thought that looked pretty ugly for it to have that white background. And it's sort of very distracting from my photograph, which is what I want people to really concentrate on. So I thought, no problem. What I need is a transparent background on that logo. And in this case, I needed the text to be white because it was on a darker background. And fortunately, there is an image format, PNG, which does support transparent backgrounds. And PNG files are also supported in my photo editor, where I could insert it as a layer on top of my photo. And you can make background transparency for free. So I started with Paint 3D, which comes with Windows 10. If it doesn't happen to be in the edition of Windows 10 that you have, you can get it in the Microsoft Store. They have a function called Magic Select, which allows you to erase parts of the image and then save that file as a PNG file, and any of the parts that you erased are left as transparent. And this is what I ended up with, and I put this against a red background so you could see the parts that were missed that are still showing up as white. And so I thought it was less than a stellar job, but quite frankly, if that was sized down to the size that I wanted to put on the corner of a photograph, probably would not be noticeable. But I thought, why not see if I can do a better job than that? So I looked at Pixlr, which is an online photo editor, and it has a function called Magic Cutout, which allows you to erase parts of the image. And it has more options than Paint 3D has, so you can adjust things like the tolerance, the softness of the edge. You can do non-contiguous areas on the image and so forth. And again, if you save it as a PNG format, all of the parts that you erased are left as transparent. And it did a much better job. Okay, so there were still, they probably don't really show up here on the Zoom. There's some very small areas that were still left as white. So it wasn't perfect, but it was pretty darn close. I went onwards and I looked at online PNG tools, which again, for free, one of their tools is to make it PNG transparent. And very similar to Pixlr, you can adjust various aspects of it. So similar color tones, you can say how close it has to be to pure white or whatever color you're erasing in order to be considered part of the thing that is going to be erased. You have edge smoothing if you have, different differences on the edges where it's not sure what to pick up and so forth. So you can play around with various features. And again, if you save it out as a PNG file, then you end up with a transparent background. This actually did the best job. And you can see on this one, it was almost perfect that every part except the lettering itself was transparent. So the three of them compared. I have Paint 3D and Pixlr and online PNG tools. One of the interesting things about Paint 3D, if you are trying to remove a background with many colors on it, so say it's, you're trying to remove the background from a person in a photograph or something like that. So you have many colors and shapes and everything like that in the background. Paint 3D could actually do a credible job for you. Pixlr and online PNG tools, and my use case was to remove a single color, white. Okay, so it would do a horrible job if I was trying to remove that just a general background from a photograph. So there is a huge benefit to having a transparent background. And so on the left-hand side, you see it without the transparent background and the white box. And on the right-hand side, you see it with the transparent background. And so you can see that it's much nicer effect on the right-hand side with the transparent background. If you have different colored backgrounds, you can end up with a problem. So in this one, you have a photograph with black along the bottom. If I tried to drop a black signature on there, it wouldn't show up. But if you have different signature files with different colors or different shades, you can pick one that will actually show up quite well against it. So what I did was I went back to my original design. I created multiple shades from pure black to pure white in 10% increments, and I removed the background from each of them. Then I ended up with 11 different signature files or logo files that I could use and choose the color or shade that I want to contrast well with what is in the background of that particular photo that I'm layering it on top of. So was it worth it? Yeah, I think so. Maybe. I was pleased with the final result, but I started thinking, well, was there really a better means to the end to get this logo onto that I could use in my photography? So my cost, it was $11 for the font, Now, I could have gone with a free font at thefonts.com. If I just searched more, I'm sure I would have found one that would have been okay. It did take me many hours to figure out everything, which tools were best to use and so forth. But overall, I found it quite fun, and it was a learning experience, which is great. But then I thought, why don't I just farm out this whole task of creating a logo? Fiverr.com is a site where hundreds or maybe even thousands of people hawk their services. And so the name comes from $5. So for $5 US is the lowest price that there is on the site, and prices go up from there. So for Canadian pricing, it's $6.50 and up. And so I went onto that site and I searched for photography logo, and up popped all kinds of them. There were dozens of people that were selling services, creating signature files for photographers. And some of them were really quite stunning. Why do you, or how do you choose one person over another on Fiverr.com? Well, all of them will list, why should you purchase from me? And some of the things that stood out to me, express 24-hour delivery. Didn't matter to me, but for your job, you know, you might find that this is something that is worthwhile. By the way, just some of the other things you can get on Fiverr.com, you can get design a website. You could have a voiceover for a video that you're creating. You can have things like translation services, data visualization. You can even get fitness lessons on Fiverr.com. So there's tons of different services that are available. You can get unlimited revisions with this particular person. Or another one, they said vector quality logos. So they are scalable without losing quality at all, including transparent PNGs, which is what I wanted. 100% satisfaction guarantee. In some cases, or in most cases, they actually have different tiered pricing, and you'll get different things depending on what you're willing to pay for. In this case, the person is charging triple in order to give you the source file. So if you want to be able to modify their file with it, or your end result, without going back to them and having them redo the work later on, you could pay a little bit extra, get the source file, maybe you can do the corrections yourself. I found this one guy, and he called himself professional graphics designer. He's out of Bangladesh, and he had 90 reviews with 5-star rating. So I thought that looked good, and I saw some of his sample files, and I kind of liked them. I liked that idea of the camera being built into the logo. And he was listed as a level 2 seller on Fiverr.com. So I looked up what does level 2 mean. And some of the things are actively working on Fiverr for more than 4 months. So not brand new to the platform. Maintaining a 4.7 star rating for more than 2 months. That's good. No warnings or disputes in 2 months. Well, that's pretty good. You know, so I'm pretty confident this guy is going to deliver quality work. And I'm not going to have an issue with, you know, I give him work to do and then I'm not happy with the result, probably. So his pricing, he had his base price was $13.18 Canadian, and then he had a standard pricing, which was double that, and that gave you the source file as well as an additional concept file that he would give you. So I emailed him, or it wasn't email, it's messaging on the site, and you can do that before you hire somebody, and I referred to a couple of his samples, told him what I liked, what I didn't like, and I gave him an extensive set of requirements. So I wanted that different levels of gray to be able to layer on bright to dark photographs. I wanted an abstract minimalist camera drawn out from the signature stroke as he had on one of his samples. I wanted a pretty plain signature typeface, so it was very readable. And for photography, I was very specific. I wanted a geometric sans-serif typeface, and so that it could size down and still be readable at small sizes. So he got back to me and said, sure, I can do that. And originally it was 24 hours. He had some other things, so he messaged me and asked me if it would be okay if he took another 24 hours. And I said, sure. So within 48 hours, I got this as the first results. It was pretty good. I liked it. So it was that minimalist camera coming out from the signature, and he had taken the upright for the T and used it from the camera logo itself. One of the things I didn't like was that he had a straight bar going across for the T. And I thought, well, first off, it's a little bit low, so it looks like it's a lowercase T. Also, it doesn't really fit in with the rest of the signature where you have a flowing I'll sign on that. And I thought that the C was a little bit large, came down a little bit low. And so what I did was I chopped things up and I mocked up a thing of what I wanted as a revision on it. So I probably could have just described this to him, but I, taking 10 or 15 minutes, I can mock this up to show him really what I wanted it to look like. So I had the smaller C moved up higher. And what I did was I actually took the tail of the Y and I just chopped that off. And I sized it up a little bit, and I pasted it in as a swash for the capital T. And so that was the sort of thing that I was really interested in having as a revision. And less than a day later, he came back with the final results, which I was really quite impressed with. I really like this. I had no other revisions that I wanted on it. I could have had unlimited revisions, but I was quite happy with my results at that point in time. He also threw in these 3D effect images as well, and I thought those might be cool to use as business cards. So I had actually taken that top right one, and I just layered on my email address and my location, and I went to vistaprint.ca. Their base price is $19 for 100 cards, and when you check out, all of a sudden it said, well, for another $2.50 or something, we'll give you 250 cards with shipping and taxes. It came out to $33.04. They arrived just yesterday, and here's a photograph of the actual business card. So I was actually pretty impressed with that. I think that this is a really nice thing that I can just hand to people and I'll say, hey, if you want a photo that I took of you, just email me. I'd be happy to send you a photograph or something like that. So of the two designs that I had, you can see the one on the right is the Fiverr.com design. With the camera logo in it, and the one on the left is my design. And I think everybody will agree that the winner is the Fiverr.com design. And I don't feel too badly because, hey, I came in second place. So second place is not too bad. So that's it for my presentation. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take those. Otherwise, we will plow on.
I noticed that there was no logo on the photo of your business card.
No logo on the photo
on
of the business
card. Of the photo of your business card.
Yeah, just a second. Let me go back to it.
No, it's okay.
Oh, you mean a photograph? Yeah, okay, gotcha. Yeah, no, I wanted something just really plain in that. I just.
No, it means you didn't. You took a photograph of your business card. You didn't put your logo on the photograph of the business card. I think that's what he's getting at.
Okay, Alan, geez, sometimes you just lose me on that. Okay. Yes.
Greg had mentioned that one of your fonts that you'd chosen much earlier. It translates to Via City, which sounds good to me.
Yes, indeed.
Unlike you, letter spacing photography, much less crowded. He was upset there was no view camera in your options.
Yes.
And you didn't put a QR code on your business card.
Yeah, I don't have anything that I would want to point a QR code to. So.
And Greg's pointing out that there's a bunch of videos on YouTube which compares Fiverr consultants.
Oh, okay. That's good. Good point. It is interesting if you go onto the Fiverr.com and you search around on there, prices do vary considerably. So the high point I saw was somebody who wanted for a WordPress website, 5 pages, they were charging between $4,000 and $6,000 for the work. And they had 4 and 5 star reviews only. So I don't know what they're doing for $4,000 to $6,000, but there are a lot of services on there that are very reasonable prices. If I was going at this again, I mean, outside of the point of it's kind of fun to create my own logo design and things like that, hey, for, you know, I spent, you know, under $30 and I got all of the files that I wanted with transparency. I got the original logo file, so it's in Adobe Illustrator format. I can't afford Adobe. Well, I don't want to afford Adobe Illustrator, which costs almost $30 a month for that. But I do use a program called Inkscape, which can import Adobe Illustrator files. So I don't have to go back to him to redo this if I want to make a minor modification to this file. I could do it myself in Inkscape. And so I was very, very happy with it. I thought it was a great deal. And I think other people might look at Fiverr.com and say, hey, rather than me doing this work on whatever, translation for website design, for, there are people, session musicians, that, you know, if you got a band and you need a session musician, there are people on Fiverr.com that are doing it. So check it out if you have need for services by anybody else. Okay, I think we will we'll move on now. So, Tom, I will turn it over to you, and you have 20 minutes, and then we will have 5 minutes for general Q&A at the end of the evening. And you'll have to unmute yourself, Tom.
I'm here. My presentation, and let's share the screen. I think it's should be this one. Yes. Windows Firewall Control. Can you?
You're not sharing it. There we go.
Okay.
Yep. Got it.
I use this continually, and I find it valuable, and it gives me a good feeling when I use it because it controls. So. Why do I use it? Well, here's the original firewall, the Windows firewall. And it's a little messy, also still accessible. There is, if you want to actually look at the rules, here's what you can do if you want to use the original Windows Firewall UI. Excuse me, my phone is acting up. So it is possible to use the original Windows Firewall, and certainly many people use it. But I find it messy and complicated and convoluted. So what about Windows Firewall Control? WFC is the name of the .exe file. So what are its advantages? It's easier to control than native interfaces. It's dynamic. You can see and control new programs when they start to access the network or old programs. And management is easier. You can add, delete, cull, edit rules from a list of them or even from the log. You can also view the log of your accesses to the network, and you can create rules from the entries. So those are the advantages. So let's get on to how it works. The main interface, there's this window, which I hardly ever use, but there's a dashboard, profiles, notifications, options, blah, blah, blah. If you right-click on the task icon down here, you get this display, and you can choose profiles, high filtering, medium filtering, low, and no filtering. The difference between this is high filtering is nothing gets in or out. So that's convenient when you want to kind of turn off your internet access completely, but not turn off your computer. Medium filtering, I'll get onto it a little later. It's kind of in between. It's fairly good, and this is what I usually run at. Low filtering, this is where you're installing a program, basically. And no filtering is where you should never, ever be. So this is the main interface. This is the program, and that's the right click on this taskbar icon. So the new program control. When you get a notification which shows up on your screen, it looks like this. It says program, name, source, remote, protocol, signed, process ID. And you can allow this program, which is what I've actually started doing. You can block this program and never let it get in, or you can block for now and ask later. If you're at a If you have some doubts as to what you should do, you can click on this button here and check this file, which will go to, which will open a VirusTotal browser tab, or you can copy the path to the clipboard and actually then take a look and see, you know, where is this file? What directory is in? Where is it coming from? And you can also constrain the rules, particular ITs, which is this, customize this rule before creating it. And let's go and see that. Program constraints. So here's what happens when you click on the program customize. And here it gives you the name, local ports. You can clear these out, or you can actually go in and edit them. So you can change the remote ports, or you can restrict it. And if you allow this program from this particular dialogue, then this will be this particular program, anti-malware service executable, which is a Microsoft program. It will be constrained to using these local ports, this remote port, this remote IP, this protocol, and of course the direction, which is what it showed up as. And you can also specify location, domain, which doesn't apply much if you're not in a local network, private or public. Private is where it basically refers to your own computer. Public is where you're attached to the internet in some way. So you can change these things. You can add in ports, you can with a comma. You can add in IPs with a comma. Usually you will ordinarily just go back to this and just allow the program if you trust it. That's what I've been doing anyway. But you can actually constrain it. And if you accept it this way, then you'll end up a bunch of rules, each specifying a local port, remote port, blah, blah, blah. But local ports really are arbitrary. So you can actually go in and just, if you click the X, it will be, it'll disappear, and that means that any local ports are allowed. So those are the program constraints. Now, what kind of rules does the Windows Firewall have? This is Windows Firewall Control, and it lists the rules. There are these particular fields that are in there, and as you can see from down here, there are more fields you can take a look at. But this is actually color-coded for you in its rules. And these are the rules of the Windows Firewall. It's not local to Windows Firewall Control. It is the rules of the firewall. And they're color-coded. Red is invalid, like this one. Basically, it means the program is missing. Pink is blocking. So I'm blocking Internet Explorer accessing anything outside itself. I don't use or like Internet Explorer, so I've blocked it. Green are outbound rules, which are kind of more important because that's how you lose information. So Windows this is the group, Windows Firewall Control, which is the default group. This is the name, it's in the program. This is the actual program as to where it comes from, and you can expand these, of course. You can also sort these rules if you want. Location, all, rather than private, public, domain. The actions, allow, and so on. And this is the example of a block. So going on, invalid rules. That's one of the advantages of this particular program, because you can display all the invalid rules. And these are usually programs that you have deleted or that have been replaced by newer programs with a different name. So these are all the things that have been replaced. And you can then right-click on these and choose to delete them, which is very convenient and cleans out the firewall from obsolete rules. Now, file verification tools. These are the things you can use to take a look at that file to see whether or not you should allow it. You can check the IP address reputation. You can check the URL with VirusTotal, which is I showed you before on one of the buttons. You can also start a whois. These are all accessed by a right click on the log or the rule. And you can read about a certain specific port if you want. For example, 21 is a common FTP port. And this will give you more information about it. You do get notifications as you go along. By the way, Windows Firewall Control has been bought by and is supported by Malwarebytes, which is why it says open Malwarebytes here. And you can display notifications for all your blocked outbound connections, which are usually new programs, because those are what showed up. You can run it in a learning mode, but I never have. I'd like to know what's happening. And you can disable it. Notifications options automatically closed, blah, blah, blah. And advanced notification use allow rules when searching for matching rules. So those are the things you can constrain this by. Filtering. This is the gross look at Windows Firewall Control. You can have high filtering where basically your access to the network is totally blocked, which is useful at times. Medium filtering, which is what I use ordinarily. Outbound connections that do not match a rule are blocked. Only the programs with allow rule are arrived. Low filtering, basically, that means that you are blocking all the things that you already blocked before, but new ones you allow through. And this is sometimes useful for when you're installing a program. And of course, no filtering at all. And there's a default automatically set medium filtering after 20 minutes if you changed it from low or no filtering. Security. One of the things I like about this is they have secure boot. And for that matter, secure profile and secure root. Secure boot automatically sets the high filtering profile at shutdown, which means when you start up Windows again, all the network connections will be blocked until you actually set it to be a medium profile. Secure profile supports having these things, the rules prevented from external tampering by other programs, such as viruses. And secure rules enables protection against, this is kind of a second layer to this. This is actually protects the rule, protects all the rules, but this actually doesn't allow the rules to be put in, but it disables them. So it's kind of a lower level, but you get more visibility of what other programs are trying to do to your rules. The connections log looks like this, and I'm sorry I only have one connection here, but if you right-click on this connection, you have these choices, allow this program, block this program, or you can customize and create. You can also open the file location in Explorer. You can check the file in VirusTotal. You can start a Whois query to see who actually has the location that's in here. This just shows time generated name program, but as you can see, there's a bunch down here. It has the IP and other stuff to the right. So you can start a Whois query on the IP, and you can verify the IP address against a list of bad IPs. So let's customize and create. So this is what happens when you click customize and create. You can edit all of these fields. So you can add a description if you want and so on. But you can also put in protocols and ports. Usually when I add a program, I delete the local ports because those are usually arbitrary. Custom ports, I may add an 80 in here. Local addresses, I usually get rid of this local address, which is the address of my computer on my network, and just get rid of it. Custom addresses, I leave alone. You can do this for a bunch of rows, such as particular, if you have, for example, a program that is actually trying to get to its source by trying to get to a whole bunch of different IPs, then these will show up in here. But and you can then edit the rule for them all, and you'll make one rule that takes care of all these log entries. You can also, although you can't see all the columns here, you can sort them by clicking on the column title. So, for example, you can sort by program and see, collect all the things, and then it's easy to select all the rows for that particular program and make a rule for it. So these are the Windows Firewall control advantages. It uses a built-in trustworthy firewall built by Microsoft. It's dynamic, it sees new programs, and it's easy to make a new rule for them or allow them or block them completely. It's powerful. You can update, create, or delete rules based on logs and rules. You can combine rules. You can actually merge rules that are similar. And one big advantage, the final advantage, is that it's free. But does anybody have any questions?
You can either ask in the chat or unmute yourself and ask audibly. I see no questions yet. So we'll just
It's Corinne. I have a question. What was the rationale in terms of using this product versus what Defender does? Maybe I missed that part. I just wanted to understand from your point of view what the difference was.
It's much, much simpler than using the original Microsoft Firewall. It's also more trustworthy than using firewalls that are part of a suite, such as, McAfee or other vendors who sell a suite, including a firewall. I haven't looked at those, so I really actually can't compare. But I can just see this as being very simple, powerful, and very complete. So this is why I like it.
Personally, I think one of the advantages of this and some other firewalls that are similar is that it allows you to very easily control outbound traffic. The built-in firewall in Windows typically just allows all outbound traffic without even looking at it. You can go in and manually create rules, but this allows you to very easily create a rule, for example, to say Internet Explorer is not allowed to access the Internet. So you can do that. Or if you have a program pop up that you don't recognize, maybe it's malware on your computer trying to access a command and control server out there, and you can block it from being able to access that very easily. So to me, that is one of the biggest advantages of a program like this. Okay, do we have any other questions? Okay, we will also open it up now for any questions on any of the presentations tonight. Do we have any further comments or questions? We have a thank you from Tom. Thank you, Tom. It was really good to be able to see a free tool that is available that gives you a lot more control over what's going on your computer. Okay, I don't see any other questions, so I think what I'll do now is I'll turn it over to Linda, who is going to lead us through the poll tonight for who wins a 2 terabyte drive.
Okay, well, there's not much more to say than what Chris has already said. So the polls to determine which of tonight's speakers will win the drive, and to qualify, they must be a non-board member and have made a member's favorite presentation. So this leaves us with two people, Stéphane Richard on building a database system to track expenses and Tom Trottier on Windows firewall control. So I'll have Chris put up the actual poll, and the question will be, who do you feel gave the best presentation tonight based on whatever criteria you wish to use? And we'll leave the poll open for about 20 seconds or so.
And we won't give the percentage results or anything like that. We don't want to embarrass one person who may have gotten less votes than the other. I will simply announce who the winner is. And I'll let Linda call it as to when I should
I think we're done.
Stop it. Okay, so I will end the poll now and announce that Stefan is the winner of the poll. And so, Stefan, somehow we will get that 2 terabyte drive to you. I'll arrange with you how we're going to get that to you. So thank you very, very much for Tom and Stefan for making presentations tonight. Keep in mind, folks, that we do have members' favorites typically once or twice a year. And so if you have something similar that you would like to, you know, give a presentation, 15 minutes, 20 minutes on a particular piece of software, hardware, or a service that you found that you'd like to share with other members, and you're willing to put on a little bit of a presentation, we will probably have another member's favorite sometime in the spring. I can't guarantee that we'll have a prize for it. This was the first time that we had a prize for member's favorite, but who knows going forward. So keep that in mind if you are willing to give a mini presentation to other people. Okay, do we have any other comments? We have Tim says, a round of applause for all presenters tonight. And Natalie, thanks all for the presentations. All were helpful. Okay. Great meeting and presentations tonight from Allison. So keep in mind that if you have any other questions, comments, by all means, you can send them into suggestion box at opcug.ca, or you can send it to any of the board members, and we'll ensure that it gets passed on. So that could be questions or comments on the survey or on any of the presentations done tonight. I already did get the database file from Stefan, so that will go up with the recording of the audio as well as his MP4 video of the creating of that database. So again, that'll be within the next couple of days. We'll see them in the past presentation section of the website for the user group. So I think we're just coming up on 9. So if there are no other further questions, then I think we will call it a night. Alan, I'll just do a shout out to you. Was there something else I was supposed to do? I typically forget to do things.
No, you'd mentioned any comments on the results of the survey for the board's consideration, send them to the suggestion box.
Yeah. So I think we are done for the evening. So thanks very much for attending, folks. And we'll see a bunch of you, I'm sure, at Q&A next week. And we'll have our general meeting coming up at the October meeting. As per usual. So thanks for coming.
Thanks to all. It was good.
Yes, interesting evening. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Good night.
I couldn't talk for 20 minutes without getting lost.
Can you stay on the line?
Hello?
Good night, everybody.
Good night, Oliver.
Chris, you need to turn the recording off.
Yeah, I just, stop recording.